All right, Mrs. Hopkins?
Yes.
Okay, I believe it is recording now. So I'm just going to ask you to state your name before we begin.
All right, my name is Colette Hopkins.
All right, thank you so much for agreeing to participate in this project. As we've talked about in the past, you know, our intention of it is to benefit the community both now and in the future. And also, like I said a few minutes ago, the goal of this questionnaire is really just to get as detailed responses as possible. So don't ever feel like you're saying too much. Just I'll ask you a question, answer it as thoroughly as you see fit, and I will, you know, I'll follow up and we'll go through the guide. Right?
Okay.
All right. So this first section is about your early life. So tell me a little bit about your place of birth and about what was going on there then and like as you were growing up.
Well, I was born in the very segregated South. I was born in Columbia, South Carolina, Richland County. I was born at Waverly Hospital, which was the black hospital, and was born to a two-parent family. My father was a community activist, and my mother ultimately was an elementary school teacher. They met in high school, and they attended this wonderful high school called Booker T. Washington High School, and they both attended Benedict College. My mother ultimately graduated from Benedict. My father did not graduate, but my two brothers also attended Benedict College. So we had kind of a history of attending historically black schools. Particularly in South Carolina, because we could not attend at that time the University of South Carolina because it was segregated. When I was going to high school, I attended W.H. Burton Elementary School, which was my neighborhood elementary school. I attended W.A. Perry Middle School, or junior high school as they were called at that time. And both of those schools were all black teachers, all black students, and they were all in my neighborhood. And I knew most of my teachers personally. We lived in the same community. They knew my parents. I was a good student. I was a good girl, a good little girl growing up. I had a great time. I went to preschool at this wonderful place. It was in the community, and it was run by the Russell family, and that's where I learned to read. I was reading by three. I was precocious and just loved going to school. When I got to high school, my parents were asked, would I participate in the integration of one of the local high schools, A.C. Flora High School? I wasn't thrilled. I wanted to go to the black high school, C.A. Johnson High School. I knew it would be fun. My friends were going there. But my parents talked to me seriously about integrating A.C. Flora High School, and a couple of my other friends, in quotation marks, mostly classmates, were also going to go. There were going to be about five of us, I think. And they said that they would drive us there every day and drive us home. That was one of the horriblest, if that is a word, time of my life. I was terrified the entire 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, and 12th grade, terrified. I don't even remember if I participated in graduation. It's kind of like I tried to X that part out of my life. This coming year will be my 50th anniversary graduating from high school. Well, I graduated in 69, so it's coming very soon, the anniversary of my having graduated from that particular high school. And when it was the 40th, they called and asked me if I would come back. And I was like, going, I don't ever want to go back there. It was such a horrible experience. I can't imagine having 4 years of that type of an experience. It was just so, the people, the teachers, the administration, the students were so cruel the entire time. I was afraid to go to the bathroom. I was afraid to go to my locker because people would push me and say horrible things to me, and my grades were affected. The good thing was that I did extremely well on the SAT, and so schools were interested in my coming there. And as a result, I think, of going to AC Flora, I got a scholarship to go to Fisk, and I accepted it almost immediately. And there's a little story behind how that happened as well. Mm-hmm. But it was during the Vietnam War that I graduated from high school, and so my brothers in South Carolina, we at that time, we had every type of military installation in the world. You know, we had five different major bases. Fort Jackson was there. The Marine Corps place was there, right on, you know, right outside of, right in South Carolina, Shaw Air Force Base. So a lot of the young men that I knew growing up were being drafted into the Army. And the only deferment you had was if you were in school. And so my parents talked to me and told me that they had to have both of my brothers in school because we were stepladders. So if I turned 12, the next one was 13, and the next one was 14. So we were all in the same age group. So while I was getting ready to go to college, they were also going to college. And so they were going to Benedict because, of course, at that time, they couldn't go to the University of South Carolina. So they were going to Benedict, the same college that my parents attended, and it was a private HBCU, and it was expensive. So they didn't have any money. There was no money for me, and I wasn't going to be drafted. So if I wanted to go to college, I better get myself a scholarship. Mm-hmm. And so we went looking at the different colleges, and, you know, and I was getting offers because of my SAT scores. And even though my grades weren't what they should have been, they weren't bad grades because my father would always go to the school and fight with the teachers over why I was being graded a certain way. I remember being in my French class, and the lady said that my grammar, my French grammar, that I spoke it with a black accent. And, you know, my mama had taught me French, you know, growing up, so I spoke French very well, but that particular teacher always graded me low, even though my written exams would always come back very well. She would grade me very low on my accent. And, you know, you never forget those little things that happened, you know, during that period, because that should have been the time when I was, you know, making friends, being engaged in clubs, all of that kind of stuff. And none of that happened. That did not happen. That was not my high school experience at all. So my going to college was, for me, a way to escape. And some of the, you know, white colleges at that time were trying to integrate, and they were looking for students. And my mother suggested, in fact, she took me up to the University of Michigan. I almost, like, laid on the floor and cried. I said, I am not going through this for more years. I'm going to a black school. You know, well, you better get a scholarship. And one day I answered the telephone, and this lady was calling me from Fisk University, and she asked if this was Colette Hopkins, and I said yes, and she told me where she was calling me from and that she was calling to offer me a scholarship to go to Fisk. And when that happened, I was like, yes, I am going to Fisk. I didn't even bat an eye. I was just like, I'm going to Fisk. And that's what I did. I went to Fisk, and I had an amazing 4 years at Fisk. It was just like I read everything I'd ever wanted to read. I had the best teachers. They just spent a lot of time with me. They didn't understand that I had been in the desert and that they had water. But that was how I felt. I'd been for 4 years in a desert where I was treated, you know, I was treated like a dog. I just want to say that, you know. You know how people talk about, you know, people would kick me, push me, say nasty things to me, write notes, you know, grade me unfairly. It was horrid. But then when I got to Fisk, I was like, oh, my gosh. And I read everything. I had a ball. My first year was just like, you know, of course I made straight A's. I made straight A's because I wanted to be in everything, do everything. I met so many wonderful people, teachers like Lou Outlaw. I did meet Lou when I was a first-year student. He was not there. And my second year, I got accepted to go to Africa to study at the University of Abidjan. And I went there, and I was like, oh, my goodness, this is like heaven. I fell in love. I fell absolutely in love with being in Africa and having, you know, friends, girlfriends. It was just wonderful. And I made friends with a lot of the other students who had traveled with me from the U.S., from Fisk. And it was like, oh, my gosh, this is how it feels. And then I came back in the second semester. I spent an entire semester there, came back, and that's when I met Lou Outlaw. And here he is talking all of this stuff. And I was like telling him, you know, Chinua Achebe taught me when I was at the University of Abidjan, because he was then out of Nigeria. And, you know, I was smart, mild, knew everything. He enjoyed my being crazy and having a big mouth and speaking up and reading. And he introduced me to a whole nother body of literature to read. And we just became very good friends and ultimately colleagues. So then, you know, I graduated from Fisk, and I did graduate summa cum laude with honors, and I won a Watson Fellowship. A Thomas J. Watson Fellowship. And, you know, everybody thought that I was going to get a Rhodes Scholarship, but I didn't want that. I wanted the one where I could travel and not be, you know, kind of like in one place. And this other guy, Leighton Brown, also wanted that scholarship. And so we were competing. We were like, you know, they came on campus and did interviews. And I got the Watson, which gave me an entire year. It actually gave me a year and a half because I went back to Africa, and your money goes longer. So I flew into Europe, spent time there. Then I went to Africa and spent an entire year just going from country to country, looking at their education systems, looking at, you know, their teaching of young children. Because I had done an education degree, because I, after having had that terrible experience with teachers, I wanted to be a teacher, and I wanted to be a fantastic teacher. And so I went to Liberia, I went to Senegal, I went to all of these different Nigeria, different countries, and just wandered, because that's what the Watson is about. It gives you a chance to work on your own independent project. And you just can't come back to the U.S. until you are done with the Watson. So I took an additional 6 months because my money went longer, and I just had a wonderful experience. When I came back to the U.S., I then went to graduate school in the AU Center at Atlanta University. I'm still pursuing degrees in education. And when I finished that, I was going to just go straight into teaching. But I met this man. This man met me, I should say, an amazing man who owned this company and had a foundation. And his goal was to provide African-American students with scholarships to get their doctorate if they made the commitment to to come back and teach at HBCUs. And I got one of those fellowships, but I had not applied to go on to get my doctorate at that time. And I went to Vanderbilt and met with their education department, and they looked at my transcripts. You know, I had always been a great student, and they said, you know, all of our fellowship money is gone for this year. I said, oh, I'm not here asking for money. I have money. And I have money to pay for me to go all the way to get my doctorate. And so I ended up going to Vanderbilt and doing my doctorate there. And when I finished Vanderbilt, well, what I did was I got an internship on my last year at Vanderbilt with the then new, very new U.S. Department of Education under Carol Bell. And I went as a hearing officer. The public law for children with disabilities was just being passed. And so I went from city to city doing hearings and presentations on public law 94-142, the Education of the Handicapped Act, and came to Atlanta as part of that experience and decided this is where I wanted to be. Ended up applying for a teaching job at Atlanta University in the same department that I had matriculated in. And the rest is history. So that's my growing up.
Awesome. Yeah, well, I definitely have some follow-up questions. I think one of the first ones that came up for me was your mentioning that your father was a community activist, which is interesting because everything you just said to me is kind of is really great story about sort of how you evolved into a community activist, particularly your investment in education as a result of having these horrible high school experiences. But I want to talk a little bit about your father. Like, what kinds of things did he do as a community activist?
Well, he had been a student at Benedict College. My mom got pregnant. He was not able to support us and, you know, stay in school. So he went to work, and a lot of young men did this. He went to work at a country club. A lot of college guys would go to these country clubs, segregated country clubs, and be waiters, caddies, do all kinds of things, and make very good money. In fact, the tips were really good. My job, I remember, was always counting the tips, you know, rolling the money into the little paper things and, you know, being able to tell him how much he made. And, you know, he thought it was cute. And I got a little bit of it for doing my little job. But so while working there, I mean, the racism must have been amazing. He worked at Forest Lake Country Club. And, you know, he would have these altercations. These, you know, people would call him a nigger. Hey, nigger, come do this for me. You know, just all kinds of things. And he really could not handle that well. And one day my mother had a kind of a meeting with us, the kids, and said, your daddy cannot work there anymore because he can't take it. You know, it was just destroying him. And so he went in the opposite way. He started, one of my neighbors, I don't know if you know this name, was I.D. Quincy Newman. And he was with Dr. King, the NAACP, and all of this. And my father and him became really good friends. And my father ended up being the president, in quotation marks, of United Black Fund of Columbia, UBF. I don't know if you know that group.
No.
But that worked on voter registration, feed the hungry, housing for poor people. And it was like he found his natural fit. And that's what he did, and that made him happy. You hear my dogs, don't you?
I just heard that. Was that a growl?
Yeah, they're growling. Anyway, So that's what he did. And my brothers joined him in that work. And, you know, he didn't make a lot of money doing it, but he was so happy doing it. It just made it, it was exactly what he needed to do with his life. And I love that he did that. I mean, I was so proud of him. And even though we didn't have any money, you know, we had a home. I always tell people I grew up as a young Black person with an intact family. My mother and father were in the home. Both of them were educated. And so what did I really have to complain about, you know? Every day I saw my dad, you know, even though my parents worked very hard, they were always in the home with us. So, you know, I grew up in a stable African-American family. You know, the literature would suggest that that really didn't exist, but I did. And I grew up in a very stable African-American neighborhood. I knew my neighbors. The kids played out in the street. We didn't fear that somebody was going to do anything to us and inside our neighborhood, you know. And we were just like, we didn't know that that was as abnormal as I've come to learn, you know, as I grew up. But, you know, at that time I thought this is how everybody lived, until one day I looked around in my class and I realized that I was probably the only young person sitting in there that had a daddy that was at home. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that was like, wow, that's kind of strange. I didn't know that so many families didn't have daddies, that that was unusual. Mm-hmm. So that's what he was. He was a, you know, voter registration, mm-hmm. feeding people, housing people. Like if a Black family got burned out, he would be there to try to find them emergency housing, to make mm-hmm. sure that they had food, to make sure that they got furniture. That's what he did daily.
Wow. Wow. What about your mother? You said that they both worked very hard. Did your mother work outside the home as well?
Oh, yeah. She ultimately did graduate from Benedict. And then she and I actually graduated on the same day. Because remember I told you she got pregnant, and so she dropped out of school, but she went back. She got her master's degree, and, you know, she was a school teacher.
Excellent. Did you know your grandparents?
Absolutely. Close set.
What were they like?
They were, my father's mother was an alcoholic. And that created a lot of problems. She was not like, you know, like people, you know, like on the street and everything. But, you know, it was very disturbing to watch that. She actually died in a car accident with my father. But she wasn't driving. She never drove or anything like that. But that made it difficult to have. She wanted to have a good relationship with her grandkids, but that was the hard part, was that she was an alcoholic. On my mother's side, my mother's mother, I didn't know my mother's father because he died before I was born. He died when my mother was a little girl, because my mother was the baby of 12 children.
Mm-hmm.
So I had aunts and cousins who were the age of my, what normally people would think your grandmother. But I knew my mother's mother, and she lived next door to my mother's only brother, and so they kind of took care of her as she aged. But she grew everything. She had gardens, she had fruit trees, and so it was always fun to go to her house, and we could walk from our house to her house. So, yeah, I knew my grandparents and enjoyed them. And I have pictures of my daughter with my great-grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
She turned 100 when my daughter was born.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you mentioned your neighborhood, and I know that high school was a time when you didn't go to high school with you know, the friends that you had, and, you know, but did you spend time with them, like, in the neighborhood? And if so, like, what kind of,
what kind of
things did you do together?
We played, we spent the night at each other's homes. You know, I had a really typical relationship with my girlfriends from even preschool. We are still friends now. We've been friends for, you know, like 60 years, and we'll die as friends. You know, even the kids that I went to AC Floral with are still my friends. And two of them actually ended up going to Fisk with me. We all ended up, two of them also went to Fisk at the same time with me. So we all escaped AC Florida. But, so I still have relationships with my friends that I grew up with. And when I'm home, my neighbors come over looking for me because I still own my mother's house. My mother lives with me now. She's lived with me for 20 years. Mm-hmm. But so we still have her home. So when I go home, I still see the people I grew up with.
That's wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah,
they stop by. They say, when you coming? When you going to be here? Don't come and don't tell nobody. You know, we're country, so they'll be real mad at me. So my mom always thinks it's funny. I go home, and in, like, 2 days, I see, like, all of these people. I drive to East Dove. I drive to Hopkins, South Carolina. I drive all of these different places to see my friends.
Mm-hmm. Your mother's neighborhood, is it still, like, predominantly Black? Like, is it?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. And was it in Columbia proper? Was it, like, in the outskirts? Like,
It's right in the middle of Columbia.
Oh, wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. So just a couple more questions about your younger years. Did you have sort of, like, favorite songs or television programs or, like,
we were the family that played music all the time, and we danced. We would move the furniture in the living room because my parents loved to dance and they loved to party. So music was definitely more important to us than TV. We had a TV, but we knew the Drifters. And my father, remember I told you he was a waiter when he was in school? Mm-hmm. In the summer, he would go to the beaches, Atlantic Beach, and down in that area, and work the parties. Mm-hmm. And we always said that was during the time of segregation. And so we would stay in these small motels for Blacks. And it was always funny that the guys who would be performing for the parties, the Black guys, they would stay in the same hotel. So the Drifters, you know, all of these groups that people would hear on the music, I didn't know that that was a big deal. You know, my mom knew that it was a big deal, but these Black groups would stay in the same hotels as the people who were waiting, and my father, and they would stay up all night talking trash, smoking cigarettes, gambling, and then we'd all go to the beach. You know, it was just fun. That, and I have, you know, pictures of me with my mom and my dad on the beaches on Atlantic Beach during that period. And it was good. So that music from that era was like the soundtrack of my life, and I still enjoy that music. So, yeah, so we were that family. People would come over to the house. My parents were always extremely social. They had all of their friends, you know, they'd go from, you know, have house parties at different people's houses. And so, yeah, even though I was at that horrible school, I still had my life outside of the school. And so when I got to be a senior in high school, like all my other friends who weren't at that horrible high school, I was a debutante for the Deltas, you know. I went to all that kind of stuff. So I still had my social life.
Wonderful, wonderful. Do you remember, like, meeting a specific, like, well, you said that when you, like, when it was happening, you weren't aware that, like, these, like, famous people, but it was there, like, a particular person you met that you were, like, you know, that you really liked their music, or, like, you know, thought they were handsome or whatever the case may be? do you?
Well, you know, this is going to sound funny, and I love this little aspect. My mother used to do makeup for gay men who would come to our house. I don't know how that happened, but different guys who would need to be made up for their shows. And I always found that fascinating. I would be like, you know, because black gay men is, you know, back then they were called sissies, but it was, that's who she would make them up, you know, make up their faces, do their hair and everything in the kitchen, in our kitchen. I was like, wow.
Right. That is interesting, particularly given the time period.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah.
So I would think my parents as being extremely progressive and engaged in the community. And what is so funny, like I take my mom to South Carolina once a month to play Pacino. I don't know if you know this game. And some of the people, they have been doing this together for maybe 60 years. I'm not sure how long, but I've known some of these same people. They've known me since I was a tiny little girl. And so when I take my mom and I take my granddaughter with me, she's the official mascot of the Pacino Club, and we're sitting there playing with people who are in their 80s and 70s, and some of them are daughters just like me. You know, the people who were in the original Pacino Club. And she was in a bridge club and, you know, all of those kinds of things. So very social. So I never grew up thinking, you know, you don't talk to this person, you don't do this, you don't. It was always, we were always in the mix, doing this, doing that.
Oh, wow. How far is Columbia from Atlanta?
3.5 hours.
Wow. Yeah, that's not far. Say it again.
I said, ask me how I know that it's 3.5 hours.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, wow. That's awesome. So, you have a family who, like a long life. Like, it's like your mother's life sounds very full. Not just long, but also full, which is wonderful.
Yeah. And very much engaged in community. And I always enjoyed that. Always recognize that this is really how you live your life. And, you know, I'm married to someone who's not as quite as outgoing as I am, but he's now used to me after 30 years. And, you know, like a neighbor across the street, he'll say, how do you know this person? I'm all up in everybody's business. We go pick up. Now he has to go pick up sometimes when he picks up our granddaughter, a little girl who lives across the street, you know. We'll drive somebody to the grocery store. They'll knock on the door and say, you know, so-and-so, can you watch my dog or can you do this? So we're those people in the neighborhood that we've lived in for 30 years.
That's awesome. Well, actually, I'm going to segue into some questions about communities and activism. So I know that I definitely know about the high school experience, but was that the first time you were consciously aware of issues concerning race, or did that happen before?
Oh, no, I knew about that. I mean, given who my father was, I definitely knew about that before going to high school. I mean, like I said, you know, I was on the beach staying in a segregated tiny little hotel, and you could see the fancy hotels where white people stayed. So I grew up seeing the disparity between the way blacks lived and were treated and how whites lived and how they treated black people. And then, you know, it was during that era where if you turned on the TV, there is no way that you did not know what was going on in terms of, you know, the right to vote. And, you know, Strom Thurmond was there during the time that I was growing up. So it was, you know, it was always in your face.
So So what experiences, certainly high school had an impact, but what other experiences shaped your sort of awakening consciousness about the need to make a difference and improve African Americans' lives?
Well, you know, watching my father, I think my father's treatment left a mark on me. And my mother was one of the first Black teachers to teach in an all-white school. And so, you know, she had to go through all kinds of, you know, hearing young kids say things to her as a teacher, and their parents not wanting her to teach their children. You know,
wow.
So growing up with that kind of, you know, backdrop. And then I should mention to you my father's people, more so than my mom, were my great grandmother what people would call now she were home within the middle of the country. And she worked that cotton as long as she could, and when we were there, we, you know, helped. She had pigs and all of that around. So, I mean, the disparity was in your face. It wasn't like, only if you made the choice not to recognize what was happening, how people talked to you when you went into the stores, and, you know, there was a separate street that Blacks shopped on, Assembly Street in South Carolina. You did not go on Main Street to shop. You know, you walk into the wrong place and people would basically tell you to get out. It was not South Carolina. It was bold, in your face, racist. I remember a young lady when I was in high school, people I had to befriend. They made her life hell. They made her life hell just because she tried to not be. And the high school I went to, the governor, daughter, Robin, also attended that high school, and she was in that clique that was just mean and vicious. And, you know, the mean girl group. And I would, you know, I would say, wow. She was Robin McNair.
Wow. The governor's daughter.
The governor's
daughter. Wow.
So it was the high school that they asked us, that the NAACP asked that we attend during that period.
Goodness. So, go ahead.
I loved it when for the 40th, somebody, that young person called me. So I'm waiting for the 50th for the person to call me again and say, will you? No. No, no, and no. And we're all still alive, the group of us, and we do keep in touch. We, you know, we know each other, you know, the Black kids who went there, and we keep in touch. But they may go back, but I won't.
I understand. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like an awful experience. And to go through that for 4 years, like your entire high school career, just sounds overwhelming.
The first year was the worst. It was the worst. But after that, it kind of just got a pattern. You knew what you did and what you didn't do, where to sit, not to sit. You know, if your grade was screwed up because the teacher was evil, you just said, oh, whatever, you know. And you just did the best you could. You survived it.
So your grades were, I think when you first said it, my first thought was like, oh, your grades were affected because you were under so much stress. But it was actually because you were being, like, penalized for basically being there, like the French teacher.
Yeah, every error was magnified. But, you know, after a while, the teachers had to accept that I was really smart. You know, they just had to say, well, you know, she actually does the work, you know, like in math. What? How do you turn math into not the grade it's supposed to be? You know, and so, you know, you might say in an essay, well, this isn't the topic or wasn't well written or something like that. But with math, with other things, you know, it got to be like, okay, she's smart. And so I ended up in the Honor Society and, you know,
things
like that. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, what do you do when you don't have a life? You do your schoolwork.
Did you read a lot as in high school? Like you did.
I read a lot, period. My mom's a reader and always loved books and, you know, and that's part of my addiction is reading, and I hate it. I think because it's, you know, like so many wonderful books in so little time.
Yes. I feel that way all the time.
Like I don't even want, I get the New York Times and I get the book section. I just hope every Sunday that there's not a book in there that I feel like I have to read. Because, I mean, you know, I have, oh, you can't, if you saw the room I'm sitting in now, you would say, oh, my God.
books.
Yeah. And I use children's books, you know.
Because
there's so many great children's books out there.
Oh, that's true. I think I've always wanted to read Jacqueline Woodson, who I think recently won.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have it on my in my living room. I actually met her a few times.
Oh, wow.
Yes, that's and awesome. I do this children's film festival, and we've used some of her books. Some of her books have been converted for children. Have been converted into films, and we've done a Jacqueline Woodson Film Festival for children.
Oh, in Atlanta.
In Atlanta.
That's awesome.
It is awesome. Yeah. Her books are awesome. Her work is awesome.
I have not had the time, but she is one of the children's authors that I've wanted to read.
Well,
I've heard such great things.
Read her. Her last book is just an amazing piece, so I won't spoil it for you. She has one book on bullying for children, and it's little girls. And this little girl at the end of it, she is just so disappointed in herself.
Because she was a bully.
She was a bully. It never uses that term. But that's what it represents. But she was a bully to a little child who, you know, never had the right clothes, never had the right supplies, who tried to befriend her, but because she wasn't like her, you know, and I said, oh, my goodness, I love this for children because it opens the door to, because kids can be, you know, unintentionally evil. And so it gives you a way to talk about those things. But, yeah, her films and her books for kids, you can get them through Scholastic.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize Scholastic was still around.
Scholastic is still around. And they send me their catalog because they know I'm one of their best customers. My husband should fire me.
Oh, my goodness. Awesome. Yeah, well, I definitely want to get to your current life and some of the things you're doing. But I'm going to start with just some questions about IBW. When and how did you get involved with IBW?
Okay. I think there are two different stories around this. Howard Dotson, for example, was working on his dissertation, and he had to do some research in South Carolina, and he needed a place to stay while there. And so I told him, I said, you can stay at my parents' house. You can have my room because I'm going to be gone. I think I was going to be in Africa for that year. And he said, are you serious? And so he hooked up with my daddy. They loved each other because they could talk crap for hours. together, you know, just talk about this thing in history and this and how it's so smart. You know, my father just loved him. So he lived at my house for, I think, I don't even know how long, maybe a semester or something. And he went through all my stuff, and I told him I was going to kick his tail about that. But anyway, and so I knew Howard. And then I was at Atlanta University in graduate school working on my master's and my EDS at that time. And I lived in the dorm directly across the street from IBW. And my father told me that I had to volunteer. He said, you have to go go across the street and volunteer. And so I did. I got there, got settled in my dorm room, walked across the street, and for 2 years while I was in graduate school, I volunteered there. And they didn't make a distinction between my being a volunteer and being a staff. They were glad to have me. You know, I had some skills, and I was consistent. You know, I was one of those good volunteers. I would come every day. I probably would just drop out of school and just stay there if I could have gotten away with it, but I could not. So I could, you know, I would go across the street every day, and I was babysitting for Al Josie. I think you've already interviewed her. So I was babysitting for Al Josie because she lived across the street from the dorm in the opposite direction, and her husband was on faculty in the School of Social Work. And so I would babysit for her and be at IBW. So my life was an IBW life. You know, between Al Josie and volunteering, I was always in that network of people, and became really good friends with Vincent Harding and, you know, the people who were actually physically in the building. Now, because I was a grad student, I was much younger than most of them. But Malika was the baby of the group, Malika Deru. And that's where I've met Malika. Even though she was a student at Clark, I didn't know her because Clark was across the street. It was undergraduates, and I was on the other side of the street in the graduate program. But I met her there. And some of the people who are now in the IBW group, which is what we talk about here in Atlanta, we're like a little group. I didn't know them as much from IBW as I did know them in the community. So, you know, so I had a personal relationship with Howard through my family, and then I knew some of them from other things that they were doing in the community, and then I got to know them at IBW as well. But Sue Ross, I didn't know at all until much later. I met Sue because I was her mother's work-study student in the School of Social Work. And she talked about Sue constantly. So when Sue moved back to Atlanta was when I met her, but I didn't meet her at IBW.
So was she away at school or?
Yeah, she was away at school. She was in California in school.
Oh, okay. Interesting. What was your role? Did you have like a designated title as a volunteer? Were you Okay. What did you do?
Whatever they told me to do. And what they liked that I did was I could listen to a lot of times the guys and you know that there was an issue about female and male relationships at IBW. Women were the worker bees and the men were the think tank. And people, I'm sure that Pat Daly talked to you about that, did she?
She did.
I know that Pat was on it, doggone it. See, I would think, I'm going to be honest, Pat was probably the first feminist that I met in my life. Because she would, I mean, they would have meetings, and the women would be expected to bring the coffee, to make the copies, and Pat would say, like, hell no. And I loved it. I loved it. And she would call them chauvinists, and, you know, she added to my vocabulary and my understanding of male-female relationships. You're like, who the hell do you think you are? Mm-hmm. And the differences in pay and all of that was called to my attention because of the IBW, the women of IBW is how they refer to themselves, the women of IBW who, you know, would raise those kinds of issues around, you know, equity and position titles and, you know, just the whole thing around you will not be talking about freedom and enslaved me. You know, it's like, you know, you can't be out here talking this shit and then you come home and, you know, IBW was home and then, you know, act like you got servants. We ain't no servants. We're here working and our work has as much value as yours. It's different, but it has as much value. And, you know, we, and it was true, we were very smart women. And we're all very smart, very intelligent, and our contribution is equal to yours. And so why are we not being paid equitably? How can you have these meetings and exclude us? That kind of thing. That was just really, I was ready for when that whole thing came about in terms of women. I wasn't even aware of it because here I'm coming from a home where my mother was the most educated. She was the primary breadwinner because my father was out doing community work. Mm-hmm. Her check was the one, you know, so I grew up thinking this is how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know that it was so much tension around it until I was put into that setting at IBW. And I was like, wow, I'm getting another education. This is good. So I was the person, I never got paid by IBW. You know, I was getting money through my different fellowships and things like that. So I didn't really need money per se, you know, probably needed it, just too dumb to understand that could have asked for it. But I was volunteering, and this was my, my role was to do whatever I was asked to do, you know, that was reasonable, and people were very reasonable and very, a very good group to work with. And then my consistently assigned duty was to help Faye Bellamy with the transcriptions of the different tapes because the people that would be doing the IBW papers and things rarely wrote things out long-handed, but they would create tapes, and then the tapes would be transcribed, and then they would edit what had been transcribed, and then we'd make the final pieces, and then it would go to the official editors who would go through it, and they had some wonderful editors. You know, and I've always admired Molly Eka because even back then, because she was like 16 when she came to IBW, even back then she was the wordsmith, you know, just amazing. And then they would come out and people, and I would look at things that would be published because we had our own printing press. You know, there, Don Edwards was the person working the printing press. He had his own little shop, and I didn't understand how any of the equipment worked on that side of the world. But then the things would come out and it would be like, wow, look at this.
Interesting. What were some of your favorite aspects of working there? I know you mentioned Pat, who you know, was very vocal about things and you appreciated that. But what were some of the other favorite things you enjoyed about working?
The conversation. It was never, you know, being in a place where people talked about ideas and not about individuals. You know, it was always so refreshing and people, the things that we were publishing, everybody in the room read, but they also read other things and would call it to your attention. There was a bookstore at IBW. So, you know, I'm a bibliophile like you, you know, and I'm reading, and I'm reading stuff that I never heard of, you know, and authors that I've never seen, and international people that, you know, I was like, I was in a candy store, and I was almost becoming diabetic. I was eating so much. But it was so refreshing. And then the people would come. People would come to Atlanta, of course, because, you know, it was the civil rights era, and people would come to Atlanta, and they would always come to IBW. They would come there because Vincent was there. And if Bill and Bobby were there, they would come, you know, they would really come. And whenever there were conferences, we would set up our books for sale. And, you know, as a volunteer, I would be one of the ones working the book tables. And, you know, you would have to be able to tell people. They would ask, well, what is this book about? And, you know, you had to have read everything and talked about it so that you could really sell it to people, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was a perfect match for me. It felt that I was learning and growing, and I was around people who were not petty. There was very little pettiness going on. And, you know, in many work environments, that's what goes on night and day. These people were there trying to change the world. It was like Pinky and the Brain. Every day, people got up and tried to change the world. And I loved it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Is there a particular book you remember reading from that time that was?
Oh, there were so many. You know, of course, for me at that time, working on the Walter Rodney stuff, you know, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. That book, but even the thought of that book was... It just changed how you looked at everything. And remember, by this time that I was at IBW, I had been to Africa. I'd been there several times. And a lot of people that I worked with at IBW had never been to Africa. I mean, you know, even though, you know, I could talk about Africa being, you know, I could use the Gil Scott-Heron thing that we're in Africa right here. You know, this is so wherever we are, wherever African people, this is Africa. Put your flag down. This is where you are. But, I mean, they had never physically been in Nigeria to see where whites lived and where blacks lived. They'd never been, you know, to, you know, like in the Ivory Coast is the Hotel Ivoire, you know, and it's very Francophone. There's the Plateau, very Francophone, you know. And then you go to where, you know, the people who own this country lived in many instances, the fabulous mansions that people would build and all of this. So, you know, having seen this and having gone to the University of Abidjan, you know, to come back and, you know, read and hear people talking about that. At that time, I had not yet been to the Caribbean to see that part of it. Later on, I got to, you know, I traveled a lot, and I've traveled. At one point, my husband and I were counting how many different countries that I've been to, not just to walk in, but to come and spend time, you know, and, you know, to have had that experience and then come and have the intellectual experience. Wow. it was amazing. It was an amazing period for me, a growth period. Intellectually, it was like I got another degree.
Wow. What were some of your least favorite things about working at IBW?
The fear, you know, because we, you know, bomb scares, that kind of stuff, feeling like you couldn't predict what was going to happen. It was a hard time as well as a great time. Watching once, and I think too, once you have a certain level of understanding about oppression, it's hard to watch how African Americans participate in their own oppression. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing that somebody else is doing it, but when we're doing it to ourselves, or we are making all kinds of crazy decisions and not supporting institutions and just not being fundamentally good to our own community. That's the hard part of once you understand and you see things through a different lens, mm-hmm. it's really hard to just keep going, you know, and keep the enthusiasm. It's really, really hard. You know, once you it's like that little story I was just talking to you about, Jacqueline Woodson's story. Mm-hmm. You know, watching this little girl oppress a little girl who had nothing but wanted to just be her friend. And this mm-hmm. girl waited too long to get her act together and could not do it. You know, that's how, you know, now as an adult, you're seeing it, you know, you see what we're doing to our children, to our community. We see our mm-hmm. elected officials, you know, being no better than anyone else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so certain things you don't want to know, but you can't put your head in the sand, but you see it and you see it repeatedly and you know, the crime, the lack of education, the lack of health care, all of these things, you know, it's not a lot has changed. A lot has changed, but the quality of life of many African Americans and just people in general just hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm. Definitely agree with that. So, let's see. Kevin, I'm going to ask you a little bit about the women. I think during the conversation we had in December, you said that Faye Bellamy, who, you know, with whom you helped transcribe How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, was sort of one of the people you were closest to. And I wanted to let you talk a little bit about that friendship, but also just about the other, like, friendships with women that you made while at IBW. What were they like?
And still have. You know, and mm-hmm. that's the thing. The good part is I don't know how to really probably articulate it clearly, but when I am a womanist, so I probably have, I want to say, hundreds of women friends.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike a lot of women who would say, you know, oh, you can't have friends, you know, you can't have women as friends and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I have always had women as friends. From, like I said, my best friend in preschool is still my friend. When I go to South mm-hmm. Carolina, if I don't tell her I'm going to be there, she's going to be upset that she didn't. You know, even if we talk on the phone or email or text or send pictures constantly, she wants to see me when I am there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there's an emergency and I say, well, my mom got sick or something, she may understand that. But if I'm there for a weekend and I don't tell her that I'm in town, she is hurt, you know. Mm-hmm. And the same thing's true about, you know, so that's preschool, elementary school, middle school. Like I mentioned, the young people that were with me when I was at that horrible high school,
mm-hmm.
you know, my friends from college, my friends that I met when I moved to Atlanta, the IBW friends, you know, Molly Ika comes to town and she expects to see us. We have dinner together. We go mm-hmm. out, and we sit there for 2 or 3 hours and we talk as if we saw each other yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
If we need something, my daughter came to town and she needed a place to stay. She stayed at Malika's. I said, call Malika. Stay at Malika's. You know what I'm saying? So it's that kind of relationship. So I look at people who say, oh, you can't have women as friends. And I look at them and say, something's wrong with you. If you can't have women as friends, you've got a problem. Because if it wasn't for my women friends, my husband doesn't always like to go out with me. I have this one friend, Deidre, and he says, call Deidre and ask if she wants to go see that movie. I called Deidre. She says, I'm coming to pick you up. I'm on my way. And he knows 4 hours later, I'm going to come back home. Because we're not just going to go see the movies. We're going to go out for a drink or go out for dinner or do whatever. But, you know, I have friends who are women that are intelligent, that I trust, that I trust my children with them. Sue Roth is my son's other mother. We used to go out with and take Marcus out, and even though he doesn't look like me, he looks more like her than me. And everybody always said to Sue, that's your son. And so we made it an agreement. Marcus belongs to Sue. So when he's in a play or he's singing or doing whatever, Sue's going to go. And they're going to take their picture, and they're going to send me a picture of them together, you know. So we share children. We share all kinds of things. And so I think that one of the things that I learned very early was that you don't that the whole concept of how women treat other women, we have to demonstrate that that's not true. We demonstrate it to our children and our relationships. You know, we are friends, and we can be friends forever. One time my friend Deidre's car broke down. I said, well, we have two cars. Come get Trevor's car, not my car. No. And she did, and she said, oh, that's really risky. I said, if Deidre was, a drunk or whatever, I probably wouldn't have said that. But she takes care of things, and she was in a bad way. And so she came and got his car and did what she had to do, brought the car back, and she was gone. It wasn't a big deal. You know, it wasn't a big deal. It was just what was supposed to be done. But, that's how that relationship with the women of IBW. And we did make Bill Dorsey an official woman. So he could be a woman. Every time we all go out, Bill Dorsey is there.
In what ways, what kinds of relationships did you have with the women, like, while you were at IBW? Like, what?
I babysat. I cleaned their houses. I helped them with whatever project they were working on. You know, when one of them, Ruth, that you didn't get to interview because she was much older than us, when she was in a senior facility, I would go and visit her and just, you know, talk with her, do whatever, you know. You just, as far as I was concerned, they were my non-biological sisters, and that's how I refer to most of my friends. Because I don't have biological sisters.
Just the two brothers.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. That's wonderful. And also inspiring, because that's the thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is the communities of which I'm a part and the women and how we share support of each other. I think that's so... It's like vital. I don't know how I would live without those networks and those like support systems. So it's wonderful to hear.
It's kind of funny to pass it on to the next generation because we don't really trust each other. And I'm not talking about we, my friends. I'm talking about we as a community. And so for people to witness trust and caring and long-term relationships One of our friends, my husband, retired about a few weeks ago. And one of our friends, they're now married, and they came. And somebody says, well, how long have you known Colette? And she turned and looked at me. She says, how long have you been married? I said, 30 years. She says, a little over 30 years. Because they remembered when Trevor and I met. And we remembered when they met. And every child that they have, and they know our kids. And, you know, these long-term, healthy relationships. You need something. If you don't call, then you didn't do the friendship justice. Don't be sick and not tell me. Don't be broke and not tell me. Tell me what you need, and maybe I can help you. So it's that. It's not just the superficial, let's go have a drink or let's go have dinner. Let's truly be friends and support each other. And I think about my different jobs that in many instances, it's my friends who call me on the phone and say, hey, you know, I got this project or I got this going on. You know, I think, you know, I'd like for you to participate in it. I want to help you with something that you're doing. Great.
That's wonderful. So I have a follow-up question about IBW. So people describe it as a place where, like, various philosophies and ideologies converge. Things like nationalism, integrationism, other kinds of political philosophies. Aside from the sort of these expected gender roles that differed between men and women, what other kinds of competing visions did you see among the members? Were there moments when there were sort of disagreements about how to achieve things or like how
every
to go about things?
Every day, every conversation, I loved it. Because people, I mean, you know, there was, I don't think there was a shy person in the building. And so people would state their ideas, their opinions. But what I loved was they would quote things from books. And, you know, I loved it. And people would arm themselves for these discussions. You didn't, and when I say armed, I'm not talking about weapons. But you would go in, you would have stayed up all night reading to make sure that you articulated and quoted it correctly. Because if you didn't, they know that they are coming for you. But, you know, I think about, you know, the discussions would be heated. They would never be disrespectful. You know, other people's ideas were to be respected. And, you know, if you differ, it did not mean that that person's idea were not worthy of consideration. But, I mean, in-house, it was constant back and forth about everything, which I love too. That was interesting. And then you say, okay, you know, I'm coming over to your house tonight for dinner. And the conversation might continue over dinner. But it was always in the spirit of we can talk about anything. But what was also true is that I don't want to say that everything was politicized, but almost everything was. How you lived, how you spent your money, it taught me so many things. How you educated your children, you know, because there was the Learning House School a block away from IBW. And most of the people who had children in that age group, that's where their kids went to school because they knew the types of things that they would be exposed to. And so, it, you know, here I am, an educator, and I'm taking all of this in, you know, that it's not by chance that they picked that particular school. It was because they wanted their children to be treated a certain way and at a very young age to be exposed to, you know, Africa, things African, you know, who were the heroes, you know, which holidays did you celebrate, you know, all of that. It was all in one. It wasn't separate. Your politics were not what you talked about. It was how you lived your life.
Mm.
And that was ingrained. You know, where did you buy your food? How did you spend your money? You know, we didn't have much money. Nobody there had much money. Even the people who, you know, were the ones being paid had very little money because most of your money went to the struggle, you know, in some way or another. I went to help somebody. So the politics weren't separate from what you were doing. And I think if people observed that, they would have problems with the contradiction. It's like nobody smoked. You know, spending money on cigarettes, are you crazy? No, nobody smoked. Now, they did weed, a lot of weed. that was a whole different conversation.
I think you may be the first person who has said that thus far. It's interesting.
Oh, they did, but you know, many of them were vegans or vegetarians. You know, we wore African clothing, not as a fashion statement, but as it was part of our political statement. You didn't just put on any T-shirt. You know, you thought about it. You know, you thought about what's on your chest. What message are you giving to others about who you are? So it was constant. It wasn't political conversations for the sake of conversation. It was in terms of everybody growing and developing and being able to do your and to understand what you were doing and the importance of how all of this fits together. So you lived it. You didn't just talk it. And when people thought that was going on, that would then be a reason for a conversation. Now, like being politically correct, like when we were talking about Pat and how women were being treated.
Mm-hmm.
And how, you know, if you worked on something, your name should be included in it. It should not be separate from only one person's name on something. So all of those kinds of things were part of the daily kinds of conversations that we would have. And when people, you know, like when the money got funny, everybody tried to figure out how do we support this family who's part of our family. You know, you're not going to suffer because there's no money. We'll figure this out.
Wonderful. I actually wanted to ask you, because when I speak to the women of IBW, I always hear, sort of here and there, I hear things about the Learning House. Tell me a little bit more about that. Like what was it affiliated with IBW? Like who established it? And
it was not affiliated with IBW. This wonderful sister named Amuiwa Skaggs, who attended FISC. This is what she did. She had this sense of how do you treat young people at the beginning when they are very young, such that they end up being conscious beings. You know, it's like we don't fight, we share, we eat healthy, we don't play like cops and robbers with pretend guns when we play. We play, you know, how do we make unity? We sing certain songs. We learn about ourselves as African people, and we start from birth to, you know, I guess when they would go off to school. So I did not have a child there, but I got to know Amuiwa and her husband, Juju, and they had three children. But, you know, the world changes you, so I don't want to be too romantic about what they were doing. I wanted to to recognize how much hard work went into their caring for other people's children.
Good, thank you. So speaking of education, a lot of people talk about IBW, like the ways that it has helped establish Black studies as a discipline, like how it was a resource for politicians and grassroots organizations at the same time. Do you think IBW achieved its mission?
Absolutely. I think if you just look at who these individuals were, you know, Howard ended up as chief of the Schomburg.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I went up with him. I didn't go up, you know, full time, but I would come up in the summer and do his summer institutes for educators. And we would, and a lot of my friends in New York were people that I met through doing that work at the Schomburg.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you think about Vincent and the work that he produced, you know, Bobby, the Garvey papers. Are you serious? Oh, my God.
Mm.
You know, so you put it all of these pieces together, Molly Eaker and her work, you know, as a publisher, as an editor, and it's ongoing. And, you know, I love it. I love it. Sue Roth and her photography.
Mm.
She has an exhibit up here now, 20 years. Photography work in Atlanta, and she had everybody, I mean, amazing. You know, she has a book out about the women that she's photographed, you know. It's amazing. It's just unbelievable who walked through those doors and who these people are and what they've contributed, not just to IBW, but to the greater society.
Wonderful. Are there any ways in which IBW did not achieve its mission? In your opinion, are there other things it could have done or should have done?
Oh, there's always that. You know, you could always talk about that side of it. But I don't think that certain institutions are meant to live forever, you know. I do believe that, you know, there were certain things that could have been done better, smarter, wiser. You know, you can always look back and critique, and, you know, but I think it served a purpose. It was an important institution. And I think the people there, the ones who, you know, I look at Betty Cheney, you know, as a playwright now, you know, she's not super famous. But, I mean, her work is meticulous. I look at Jillian and her books and her films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people are doing important work still. It's different from what they did at IBW, but it is IBW that gave them the vision. So if they just continue to be whoever they are, it's wonderful. It's amazing. And then we're rearing the next generation. You know, I look at my own children, and I'm so proud of them that they're, you know, articulate, political, engaged, all of those things. And now, you know, I have grandchildren that we're putting these little stamps on as well. And so I don't think, you know, that the brick and mortar part of it is gone. You know, that's gone. But the what we learn from that is how we live our lives and the quality of life that we are living. And I don't see any of us sitting on our hands saying, woe is me. Everybody's engaged in whatever it is that they do, and they're passionate and amazing people. I love it. So.
Wonderful. Yeah, I think the first time we spoke, you said something I think was just really powerful. You like institutions don't really die, or when they do, they only die if we let them die. So it's like it's what you do afterwards that keeps that legacy alive. Yeah,
you keep you keep walking forward. You can't walk backwards. You know, why would I want to do that? so what I want to do is touch the next two generations and share, you know, and I do love it when young people ask me, so how did you figure out who you were going to be? You know, how did you do this and this and this and that? Why did you do that? And, you know, you all of that comes from having experiences like being around these individuals and being at that particular institution.
Wonderful. So you said you were at IBW for 2 years. Did you leave sort of like just once your graduate work was done? What made you leave?
Well, I went to graduate school. I went to Vanderbilt.
Mm.
Yeah, I went to work on my doctorate. So that's what happened.
Okay. I'm sorry you left. Okay.
Back to Atlanta when I finished. I knew that.
Yes.
I went to do my graduate work. Then I went to Washington, and then I came back to Atlanta.
Washington, D.C. or Washington State?
Washington, D.C. I went to remember I told you I went to the U.S. Department of Ed.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let me see. You may have answered my follow-up question, but well, in your words, like when did the IBW close and why? And I know we've talked about it as an institution and the people who are still moving on and doing work. But when did you hear about it closing? Like what happened around that time?
Well, the money, you know, you had to, people needed to be paid. The bomb threats, it was a lot going on during that era. I wasn't there when it officially closed, but, you know, you could predict that people had to get other jobs if they could not be paid and, you know, those kinds of things.
Thank you. I'm gonna shift into some questions about your mini travels, which I'm personally interested in, because I find myself doing more of that now, and travel makes me anxious. So I am interested in hearing about where you went and some of your experiences there. But let's talk about that. So was when you went to the University of Abidjan, was the Ivory Coast sort of the first foreign country you visited, or had you been other places?
It was the first foreign country that I visited.
Mm. What were your impressions? Oh,
I loved it. I mean, I was so excited. I was glad that I went with a group, though, because there were about 10 of us. Janice, Mays, there were about 10 of us, and I think there were two men, so there were 8 women, and we shared rooms. So I had my roommate was my classmate at FISC, and it was amazing. I was so glad that I could afford to do it, that my parents made it possible. My mother was so excited. And a lot of people question, why is she going to Africa? You know, that kind of crazy stuff. But my mother said, oh, no, she's going to have a ball. Go learn everything. And that's what I tried to do. I was there during the time when the University of Abidjan was the major Francophone university on the continent. So some of everybody was there. I loved. It was so different from FISC, you know, in the way that it was very European in how we were taught. You know, the lecturer would come in and they would stand at the front of the room and lecture and leave. Class is over. Mm-hmm. And if you got it, great. If you didn't, you weren't going to see that person again until the next week.
Mm-hmm.
And The interesting thing was, of course, I had taken French before I went. But did I understand French to that level?
Mm.
No. So I had to really work on my French. And then, you know, there were very subtle differences in how French was spoken in France. My teacher and the person who traveled with us was from France. And so the French language as spoken in the Ivory Coast at that time was a little bit different. But what I loved about it was that because of the scholars who were there, so many people came from other countries, and I loved that. So I got to meet friends from other countries, and I knew that I was going to come back to Abidjan. I knew it when I left there. I said, there is no way I'm not coming back to this country. I didn't know I was going to get a Watson. I didn't even know at that time what a Watson was. But I knew that I was going to come back because I just loved it so much. So that was a semester. That was my first experience out of the United States. My first experience on the continent. All of these beautiful women, I mean, just I had no idea what I was going to experience. And so I fell in love. I felt like Langston Hughes. I just fell absolutely in love with being in Africa.
So as an African-American woman, how are you treated?
Well, I don't think that people knew I was African-American until I opened my mouth, you know, and they would hear my accent because, you know, I'm kind of a little brown thing. They would refer to me as Matisse, of course, mixed. You know, I was mixed, but, you know, from their perspective, I was Matisse. And, you know, I had a little tiny afro even then. But I would wear, you know, my hair wrapped, and as soon as I could get to a tailor, I had as many African clothes as most of them. We would go to the Grand Bazaar and buy fabric and then ask, you know, our friends that we met to take us to their tailor. You see somebody in some outfit and you say, I want that outfit right there. To their tailor, and for the equivalent of $30, you'd have this beautiful outfit.
Oh, wow. But you did say, you said that money lasted longer in Africa. So that's very reasonable.
Yeah. Everything was so much cheaper than the U.S., you know. And I was amazed that medicine, food, clothing, transportation. But they all thought that we were rich, and I guess we were compared to them. You know, who takes a plane to Africa and spends a semester abroad if you don't have the financial means to do that? So
That's true. Did you feel freer, like more beautiful, more desirable as a Black woman traveler, not only to the Ivory Coast but to some of the other countries you've been to? Like how? How do you feel? Do you have any particular?
I always grew up thinking I was the cutest thing on earth. Remember, I'm the only girl, the baby, and I had a father who doted on me. So I always thought I was cute. So that doesn't have nothing to do with me.
Oh, wow. Let's see. So you definitely you did work in Africa. I think you mentioned working as like a lactation specialist. Am I getting that right?
Well, I had a lot of, so the later part of my Africa experiences, I worked with Kofi Boda. I don't know if you know Dr. Boda.
No.
Amazing man. He was actually the person who hired me once I had my doctorate to come to Atlanta University. He hired me and my husband, but we were not a couple at that time. And he hired me, and then after I'd been at Atlanta University about 6 years, he hired me to work directly with him. And he was from Ghana, an amazing scholar and knew how to raise money at an HBCU. And so I worked with him in his research center, and my job was to write grants, particularly focusing on development projects. So I wrote USAID grants, and in many instances, I would be the principal investigator. Mm-hmm. So we had projects in lots of different African countries. We had an infant survival project in Egypt for a decade. So you know, I would go to Egypt on that particular project. We had, you know, we just had different projects all over the continent, Madagascar, South Africa, Lesotho, you know, just development projects in education, in women in development. You know, those were the kinds of projects that I would work on. So they would give me entree to going back to Africa, you know, as a principal investigator, as a project director. And it was good work. I loved it. I did that for, I guess, I was at CAU for maybe 20 years or so. I'm not even sure. I'd probably go back and figure all of that out, too.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead. Say it again.
I said it was about 20 years that I was here.
So was it like from the 80s to the 2000s? Like when did you, around what time did you start working at CAU? Was it like shortly after finishing up at Vanderbilt or? You went to D.C. first. And then
I went to D.C. and I went to D.C. as an intern, remember, for the U.S. Department of Ed. So it was an internship, but it was not like traditional internships. It was a graduate internship where I was actually in being kind of groomed to be a national leader in this new thing coming out of the U.S. Department of Education. And I did that until, you know, D.C. and I didn't, it wasn't a good fit. I felt it was too expensive and a lot of different things. And so I really wanted to find my way back to Atlanta. And one of my friends sent me a job description, not for me, but for me to try to share with people because I was traveling in that job as well. It was just domestic travel. And she said, you may meet somebody who wants to come to AU as an instructor in our graduate education program. I was like, girl, please. I didn't even share that job description with anybody.
And you applied for it.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. And got it. Wow.
Well, I mean, you know, new PhD. And remember, my PhD was paid for by somebody who wanted the people who received their PhDs to teach at historically black colleges. So I was fulfilling that part of my, you know, having gone to graduate school on his dime. It was Britt. Do you know the Nibrit brothers?
That name sounds familiar. Tell me more.
His brother at the time was the president of Howard University. But Samuel developed this foundation, which was housed right on in Atlanta, where he supplied monies to fund people like me to go to graduate school and get their doctorate to come back and teach at historically black colleges. So for, you know, for every year that he paid for me to be at Vanderbilt, and he paid for everything, room, board, tuition, you got a stipend each month, you did not have to work, and then, you know, the expectation was that you'd come back and teach at a HBCU, and I did it. And I actually met him, and I told you that I actually found a picture of me with him. He's now deceased, but he was amazing, and he knew exactly who I was. He said, yes, I know you. I said, do you know me? My name is Colette Hopkins. He says, oh, Dr. Hopkins. And, you know, it's like, and somebody took a picture of us together that day, and I was just like, I love this picture of this man who sent me to get my doctorate. So.
Yes. So you started back at Clark Atlanta as an instructor.
Assistant professor. Uh-huh.
Yes, as an assistant professor. And then you segued into that project with Dr. Boda, or like how did that?
He actually just, my husband became dean of the School of Ed at Clark Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I couldn't work in the School of Ed anymore.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because he would have been, one of my supervisors.
Yes, the conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he, Dr. Boda asked me, would I be interested in working with him? Little did I know that this man was going to take over my entire life.
And the work you did with him, about 2 decades.
Wow.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Hold on.
Yeah. Sure.
Hi.
Hello?
Yes. My mother is having a medical emergency right now.
Oh, no.
Yes. So can I, how much longer?
I had about, I think I'm on page 4 of 5. So.
Okay.
Do
so
have
can
a
I call you back? Can I check on her and then call you back?
Absolutely. Yes. Please do that. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. I hope everything's okay.
Me too. Bye-bye.
Bye.